Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanny Show. I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
We have three special guests today. We have John Chu, Emily Zhang, and E. Lily Yu.
Yay!
Awesome.
Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, I'm not sure which direction we'll start, so where did you want to start, Julia?
Okay, so basically, first of all, I wanted to say that we saw Emily and Lily read earlier, and they were amazing, so that was awesome.
Emily had a picture book.
I would love to start with Emily's picture book, which is just coming out in April, I think.
Yes.
So it's called Summoning the Phoenix, and it's all about Chinese musical instruments, but tell us about how you got the idea for this book and how it came into being and what it's about.
Well, I'm not going to go into depth because I am going to do Scalzi's big idea for the spark of it, but basically I was doing research for a novel and got really into the Chinese music aspect of it, the traditional Chinese instruments, and in my research I was reading all these articles that kind of downplayed the importance of Chinese music and the significance of Chinese music as compared to what we consider Western music, European origin music. And I got a little angry and I thought, this is not okay, because Chinese music has a thousands of year old tradition. It's been around for a long, long, long time. And I wanted to do a picture book because I wanted to spread the love of Chinese music to, you know, the next generation, so that... Thank you, Lily.
Okay, for the
She's
listeners,
playing imaginary instruments.
At home, Lily is, like, playing the orchestration of this on her air instrument.
I wish I had a video camera to capture it, because the point was that no one would know what I was doing.
Too late.
You were like, I'm going to be silly, and so now everyone knows.
It was really brilliant, actually. So the picture book came out of that. I was really lucky to find a publisher and an editor who was incredibly enthusiastic about the topic, and, you know, it came out, so I'm excited. Thank you.
And I don't know if you're going to talk about this in the big idea, but we've never had somebody who's done a picture book on this show.
Oh, yeah.
As far as we know, but we've never talked to anybody who's got one. Mm-hmm. So what was the path to that particular publishing?
Well, in a traditional publishing path, the author submits a manuscript, and a lot of people come to me and say, well, where can I find an illustrator? And I tell them, you're not supposed to find the illustrator, the publisher will find it for you. Your editor will have a lot of contacts with other really amazing illustrators, and will have this idea in mind for the kind of style that the editor is looking for, and we'll find your illustrator for you. It's also really common for a first-time debut author to be paired with a more established illustrator, because there are a lot of people out there who collect picture books, and collect picture books, you know, written by certain authors and or illustrated by certain artists. So in traditional publishing, that is usually the case. Now, in my case, it was a little more unusual because my editor was very open to suggestions, and I did a lot of research and went to a conference and looked through 200 portfolios and found the ones I liked the best, suggested them to her, and was really, really fortunate that my editor and I had very similar tastes and thought that our top choice was the choice. So, yeah.
So your illustrator is April Chu, is that the right name?
Yes, April Chu. She's wonderful.
Have you met her in person?
I have, but I was not allowed to meet her until, or even, you know, really communicate with her until after she had finished the artwork on her book. And for some people, that's kind of
mind-boggling,
yeah. Right? Like, I can see from your expression that you're like, what? And actually, there's a lot of really good reasons for this. And again, we're going through traditional publishing themes, which is, as a picture book author, your expertise is words, not images. You know, you didn't usually go to design school if you're purely a writer. And so therefore, you want to give space, because a picture book, unlike a comic book script, where the writer gives a lot of direction to the illustrator, a picture book is more of a collaboration. You know, the writer brings 50%, and then the illustrator brings their own cool, whimsy, weird way of looking at the world through their art. And if you were to art direct, you as the author were to art direct to the writer, to the artist, and especially if you don't have any training in design or art illustration, it's very possible that your art direction might close off creativity for the illustrator. So I think that, you know, for me, all I was given, all I was told is I was given, you know, I'm giving her the manuscript, and then I asked my publisher and my editor, would it be possible if we could make the children mostly Asian, Chinese-looking, and then have some ethnic diversity overall? Because for me, part of the whole point of the book is it's an American book, first and foremost. You know, we are Chinese-American, and everything's in English. And so I wanted to really strike a point home that Chinese music can be enjoyed by everyone, just as, you know, anyone can play the erhu and really just, you know, enjoy it, just like anyone could learn the violin, no matter what their ethnic background is. So.
Congratulations on the release of the book.
Thank you.
It is wonderful. It is beautiful.
Thank you.
So your publisher, Lian Lo, is famous and unusual for being a publisher of diverse children's books.
Absolutely.
You talked a bit about the editing process. What was everything after that like, working with them?
It was interesting. I mean, my book was originally a Shen's book. Shen's was an independent publisher, and a very, very tiny independent publisher, basically a one-woman show. And, you know, she's wonderful and awesome and experienced and a fantastic work with. And Lian Lo bought Shen's just as my book was about to, you know, within the original time frame of when the book was supposed to come out in fall 2013, you know, I was told that, you know, that we might have a transition. And so, therefore, my book was grandfathered into Lian Lo. But I find them very supportive. They're wonderfully nice. And my editor, Louise, is, you know, has really great, you know, edits right before we put the book to print, and there's a great marketing department, and there's just departments to work with all of a sudden, which is interesting. And I really like them. I really love what they do in terms of advocacy for multicultural children's literature, and they have some really great articles, and they publish some really wonderful authors and illustrators, and, you know, we really just need to have more. And one of the articles they published was a kind of a round table of various children's literature experts, you know, books, librarians and authors and whatnot. And the question was, you know, why hasn't the rate of multicultural children's books being published in the United States, why has it remained the same in the past 18 years in terms of the percentage of books that have people of color as the, you know, the protagonist, the center of the book. There's a really startling study. They used this study that was, now I'm going to forget the name, but there was a study on the internet where they counted out of, you know, and every year they counted about 3,200 books that they received.
So are you talking about Melinda Lowe's diversity in YA stats that she's done?
No, this is actually another cooperative, and Melinda's great, and so is Cindy, who also runs
Cindy Pine.
They're great, and they definitely do wonderful work. But this statistic was
once again, playing lovely instruments.
Lily is playing
silent
instrument.
Add some ambiance.
Thank you for breaking the tension. Anyway, so in the New York Times, there was an article March 15th, and there were two of them, one by Walter Dean Myers and one by Christopher Myers, and the question was, where are the children of people of color in children's books? And again, you know, taking the statistics and...
Ooh, it was 92 out of about 3,000 in your
yeah.
article.
And that was yeah. the black, you know, the, yeah. those black, black kids, yeah. not African-Americans. And yeah. I actually went... and went to the study, which was also referred by Lee and Lowe, and counted, you know, added up all the minority populations, and the total was 215 over 3,200, which is less than 8%. And if you think about that, in 2012, for example, less than 8% in 2012 of the books have people of color, or about people of color. And the books by people of color are even smaller in terms of percentage and the amount. And if you think about it, though, the birth rate of non-white babies in the United States has finally exceeded the birth rate of white babies in the United States as of maybe even 2-3 years ago. So all these kids that we're raising in America, where are they going to find the books, you know, that where they can go, point at the character and be like, well, that character kind of looks like me, or I can really identify that with that character because I have the same hair that needs to be treated differently.
Yeah. Forget that. The minority population of the U.S. is over 30% now. Where were the books when we were growing up?
Yeah, that's true. I'm a Latina, like, for me, I also am aware of this extremely, and I think the numbers for Latina characters in books are really low.
They're really low.
And especially if you get into the genres like fantasy and science fiction, which were the books that I was reading a lot as a kid. I would go for all of the fantasy books, and they pretty much were mostly white. You don't see a lot of yourself reflected in them if you're not white.
We were just talking about Lawrence Yip. He was really the only author you could read growing up in YA who was Asian.
Yeah, Lawrence Yip, and there was also Farewell to Manzanar by Jean...
Oh, yes, I read that
book. Which is a memoir, not fiction.
Yeah.
And I've actually got to meet her. She's amazing. Very, very few. You can count on your fingers how many there are. Now, thankfully, in the past 5-10 years, there's just been a surge in terms of, like, more new authors, people who are people of color, getting published for the first time, and publishing books that are about and for people of color and children of color and teens of color, but then hopefully can be also...
enjoyed by everyone.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. And so I think that's kind of the trend that I see in terms of we really have this need and we need to really fill this need. And especially for fantasy too, because it's not just the issue with a lot of multicultural children's books is that there's a lot of 101 topics, you know, children of immigrant topics where I'm not really from my parents' culture and I'm not really from, you know, America and where am I? And we need to go beyond that. And I see books that are getting published that are no longer, the focus of the narrative is no longer who am I as a hybrid American, but I happen to be, you know, Asian American and really love to do all these other things and be a spy, you know, or have adventures and, or, you know, eventually, you know, have my own fantasy.
We want those books that feature the characters that are doing all sorts of things and not just being reduced to an identity.
Absolutely. And and just a really quick plug again for another imprint of my publisher, Lee and Lowe. Two books. It's a wonderful, what is doing some really great, wonderful work, and all they do is multicultural fantasy, which I love, and characters starring in fantasy. And I think that's just going to keep continuing.
Okay, so I'm going to switch gears entirely. Talking about bringing in different cultures, Lily, the story you read this morning, which culture were you actually...
It was set in Cairo.
Cairo, okay, so it was
Egypt.
First of all, tell us the name of the story and where we can find it so that people who are listening could actually read it, because it was in a McSweeney's collection?
It was McSweeney's 45. It was in December of 2013. It's called The Pilgrim and the Angel, and podcast is going to be recording it shortly.
Oh, great!
So
that's awesome. So when you decided to do this and you were writing, obviously, outside of your own experience, what did you do to try to just make sure that you weren't doing something that
being
was,
a tourist,
that was kind of not going to hurt other people?
I interned in Egypt for 2.5 months in 2009.
Whoa. Cool.
So it was a lot of my own experience.
Okay.
Otherwise, it was just writing a good story with real human beings.
It was a very good story. And it's very funny. I think that having read some of your other work, I'm used to a more serious tone, but this was very, very funny.
I write at least as many happy stories as I do sad ones, but the happy ones don't sell.
Humor is hard to sell sometimes.
Not even humor, just happy endings. So
well, you should try sending it to me sometime, because it might sell. You just never know.
Or make them suffer more before so that they can earn their happy ending.
Right. Yeah, that's a good way to do it.
So you say you write as many happy stories as you do sad stories, but the sad ones are easier to sell?
Possibly easier to write, too.
Yeah?
Write well, yeah.
What do you think that is?
Heck, I know, I'm not a publisher.
Well, as a writer, though, you say they're easier to write.
I am the worst judge of my own work, I'm guessing, based on...
Okay. So you're also the winner of the Campbell Award for the Anarchist Wasps,
Woo-hoo!
Or the Cartographer Wasps and the Anarchist Bees,
Woo-hoo!
Which I think every single person I've ever talked to has been like, that was an amazing story.
Which it was.
It was. She's looking so, so uncomfortable. You should start playing your instruments again. You'll feel better. But yeah, so that story was this really wonderful story. Did you expect when you sold it the amount of response that you would get?
Oh, hell no. At that point, I was still paying people cookies to read my stories in the first place. Every single person who read that story and gave me comments on it got cookies. If I didn't, please let me know. I owe you cookies.
And how did it feel to when you did realize like just how big this was actually getting to be?
I don't think I ever really realized.
Okay.
I was published, I think I was a senior in college then. And the academic work was knocking me out. I got the Nebula call. I missed the Nebula call because I was napping on a couch in the student center before a rehearsal. And I woke up and I looked at my cell phone and I listened to the voicemail and I was like, I'm still asleep. Okay, good night. And I walked into the rehearsal and I said, guys, I got this phone call saying maybe I'm Nebula nominated for the Nebula Award. And they're all like, what is that? It wasn't very helpful to my sense of reality, and I called home and told my mom, and she's like, that's wonderful, what is that? No, it's never quite so good.
I think that is one of the things, if you have most of your life outside of the world of science fiction and fantasy, and then you do something that's cool within the community, and you tell your friends, like my local friends are always like, oh, that's nice, so you were nominated for a Hugo. Okay. What is that? You're like, oh yeah, I don't have an ego. It's just done.
No. Especially when they ask that question, because then you're just like, crap.
Like, what is that? My mom, to her credit, was super excited. She was like, oh, that's what they say on the front of books. It says Hugo nominee. That's you now. And I was like, I'm so glad you have any point of reference for this.
They were really, really happy for me. They just had no idea what they were happy for.
Fair enough.
All right, so, John, you are a writer, and also you've done some translation work and all sorts of stuff. First of all, one of the stories that I keep hearing everybody talk about that I've read and is wonderful is The Water That Falls on You from Nowhere.
Woo!
Woohoo! So tell us a little bit about what that story is about, and if you remember how it came about, how you decided to write that one.
Okay, The Water That Falls on You from Nowhere. At this point, I'm calling it my Chinese-American fantasy, Chinese-American coming-out story with slight fantasy elements, which makes it sound much more bureaucratic than the story actually is. I know it's been a bunch of years since I wrote it. I mean, I remember one inspiration was that, left to my own devices, all of my stories turned into musical comedies. And I kept writing these stories about these two people, where they puzzle over whether they're in love with each other or not. So I decided I would write a story where we know from the first scene that they are absolutely, definitely, positively, completely in love. This is a non-negotiable. And then we would see where it goes from there. And then I decided the way they would figure, they would know this is that a lot of water would fall on them. And then that's actually how the story sort of started spiraling out.
Okay. Fascinating. So when you had this idea, it kind of like, did it come out of a frustration of having written all these stories where you're like, we're puzzling out our love?
Well, it sort of came out of, okay, I have written the same story 5 times, which, by the way, none of you will ever read of those stories. But and it's like, okay, so number 6 will be something else.
Lily's like, I want to read this story.
No. Lots of dead bodies buried in various closets that will never be unearthed.
That's just making her more excited to read it.
It really is.
I realize it's not only.
She basically has the same expression that my cat has when she can smell that I'm eating tuna. And she's like, gets this look and she comes up and she's like,
hello.
Are you going to give any of that to me? That's Lily with your story.
My cat does the same thing from time to time.
But that's basically how it started, how the rest, I have no idea where the rest came from. I really don't.
Tell us a little bit about translation, and particularly, so I know that Emily and you both speak some Mandarin, because Emily was teaching all of us Mandarin earlier during her reading, which was amazing, and all of us felt like we were kind of in kindergarten. And
she warned us ahead of time. She said, I'm going to treat you all like children. And she'd walk with the picture book, like, you were already rehearsing when you're going to go on tour with this book.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Thank you.
The best part about that was that after that, when Lily stood up to read, and she was like, okay, everybody, take a stretch break.
No. The best part was the lollipops.
Oh, the lollipops. Yes. Yeah. Emily brought us lollipops. It was really a fantastic reading all around.
Thank you guys for coming.
So you obviously both speak some Mandarin. So tell me a little bit about your background. Were you both born in the U.S.?
I was actually born in Taiwan.
Okay. When did you come to the U.S.?
Born was around 6, 7-ish, somewhere around there.
Okay. Was Mandarin your first language?
Yes.
All right. And so do you figure that you're very fluent at this point? Or have you lost a lot of it?
Well, okay. It's tricky because, like, a lot of times, like if I'm speaking to family or people I know, I can hold a fairly decent conversation. If I'm speaking to strangers, it's as if they were speaking Albanian.
Oh.
As if they were speaking Albanian?
Or I am. I can't tell.
Okay.
Maybe both?
But part of it is I get very insecure. And it's like, and all sorts of things that I should be able to say, I end up not saying. It's actually very embarrassing.
But you do some work with translation,
yes.
You're comfortable enough that you can kind of...
Oh, well, it's much easier if you're reading and writing because there's no one looking at you expecting an answer.
And you're translating from Mandarin to English?
Just from Chinese to English.
Okay.
No, I would never go the other way. I don't feel confident enough in my ability to write a coherent Chinese sentence that people will go, oh my god, this is a lovely sentence.
Do you read, I've heard before, but I'd never actually read most of this, but I've heard that in China, there's a very active SF community, and there are a lot of magazines and books that we don't get translated over here. Do you ever read those?
I read some of it. I actually have a pile sitting on my desk at home right now.
Is it Kuan Shijian?
No, but you have to tell me who wrote that.
No, that's the science fiction. That's science fiction world. Science fiction world.
That's actually sitting on my iPad.
Oh, okay. Another digital.
Yeah, well, because it's really hard to get them on paper.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
You have to go to a newsstand in Beijing and ask for them, and sometimes they will not have them.
It's true.
So you are all familiar with this magazine?
Yes, it's the largest, has the largest circulation in all of China.
It has the largest circulation
in all of the world.
In the world, yeah. Yeah, see, I thought I'd heard something about that before.
Yeah, 150,000, I think. Right now?
I'm not sure.
No.
No,
you guys, no.
What is it?
Is it more
than that? Okay. So when I was in Chicago, I was not on one, not two, not three, but 4 panels on Chinese science fiction.
Yes.
I was the only person who was Chinese American on that panel. Everyone else was either more fluent in Chinese than I was, like scholars, or actually from China, writers from China. It was wonderful. And I feel very, very lucky to have met a lot of these wonderful people. And so therefore, the statistic that I am quoting is from my memories from Chicago, which is Science Fiction World had a subscription a few years ago that was maybe under 100,000. And then within a year, it went up to perhaps as high as 500,000.
Wow.
Subscriptions. And that was maybe a couple years ago. I don't know what the current statistic is because I should have looked that up. But yeah, it's a hugely growing market. And the reason for that is because the Chinese government, a while ago, about a generation ago, decided they wanted to raise a whole generation of science fiction readers, because in order to have if people who read science fiction tend to go into science jobs like engineering and all that, and those are the kinds of jobs that they viewed as helping China become competitive with the rest of the world, because the progressive nations had, you know, the innovative scientists, and then you feed that innovation with science fiction. So. And that's why they just actively, from, you know, childhood, encouraged a whole generation of science fiction readers. So it's kind of awesome.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So is that mostly stories that were written by Chinese authors, or do
absolutely.
They take stories from all over the world?
They actually do some translation into Chinese.
Yeah,
okay.
They do a lot of translation.
Yes.
A lot.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating with that is that the people who... translate are just kind of picking up whatever they see and then translating it, whatever hits their squee and then translating it. So a lot of people in China who are, they're getting like Bradbury alongside the newest bestseller, you know, and they're reading them all kind of simultaneously. So
awesome.
There's no like real clear progression. Like they didn't go out and translate the Golden Age first, and then, you know, the science fiction from the 60s and 70s first from the United States.
It's like a hodgepodge.
Yeah, so they're really just kind of absorbing it all in. So
honestly, that's how, like, how I read as a child.
Uh-huh.
My father had all sorts of science fiction books from the 60s,
uh-huh.
and I would read those, but then I would also just be picking up whatever I found in bookstores or the library.
Yeah.
So like it, I think that's a great thing. To
absolutely.
Have this variety.
Yeah, and I think another one of the interesting things about the Chinese market is, because it's so darn big, there are some English language writers who presumably write under pseudonyms, who have their work just translated. They write in English, have it translated, and they almost exclusively sell in China.
I was aware of that.
Really?
Yeah. There was a story about it, I want to say it was a guest on Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing a few years ago. I'll see if I can hunt it down.
Okay.
Yeah,
that'd
never
be cool.
Heard
I'd love
that
to
before.
Know. That's
fascinating.
Yeah.
So, what kind of translations have you done? You're bringing Chinese language work to English speaking world.
Yeah. I'm mostly just getting started at this point. I'm still sort of at this point, I'm working on a couple of stories by Tang Fei, who is
brilliant and awesome.
Who is an amazing writer. Like I read her works, and I'm like, I must render this in English to the best of my capabilities.
I met her at WorldCon, and she gave me her card. And it has, I feel like this, I just have to share this. It has a picture of a rabbit wearing glasses on it.
Uh-huh.
It's the cutest thing.
It is.
She's awesome.
I met her at WorldCon. So I'm doing some work with that. The other thing that I've done is I ended up doing some work with Ken Liu on the first book of Senti, Liu Cixin, he has a trilogy called the first book of which will actually come out in Tor.
Right.
That's
right. Yep.
Yeah. The English title is The Three Body Problem, and I was one of the beta readers, and I was one of the people that went through and cross checked the Chinese against the English translation.
Why don't you give some context about what this novel, like, why this novel
I don't think I can really summarize this novel within a decent period of time. the premise is basically that in the 1960s, during the Cultural Revolution, we discover aliens. Because we discover this way of communicating over vast distances. We discover this way of amplifying signals such that they can carry over across vast distances of space, and we come to the attention of an alien civilization who are not friendly. And everything kind of spirals out from there. There's actually a lot of really cool stuff in it, and I mean, Ken's translation is amazing. It is fluent, and it is actually, and I can now vouch that it's actually very true to the original, because one of the things that I did for Ken was go through and read the Chinese in parallel with the English and then cross check. Which for me was a terrific experience, because it was like translation with training wheels, because I could see how sentences in Chinese become sort of these sentences that mean the same things in English but are completely differently structured, because they're two very different languages.
Right.
Like English has this obsession with verbs and Chinese has this obsession with nouns. So a lot of things that you would describe using a verb in English are like nouns in Chinese. Or vice versa, and so for me that was a great entree into translation, because I get to sort of to learn from the master, as it were.
Okay, so this is called the Three Body Problem in English. What's the name of the author?
Liu Cixin. He is huge in China. They adore him.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why it's coming. It's the best selling science fiction novel in all of China. So.
Wow.
Hopefully it'll be a nice...
When you say best-selling science fiction novel in all of China, and you told us that Science Fiction World is selling 500,000 copies, like, how many copies is a best-selling novel?
Probably more. I'd have to look it up on Google.
Okay. but something very big, bigger than the magazine, probably.
Yeah.
But when I was speaking with members of Chinese fandom at, the Chicago Worldcon, mm-hmm. If you ask them, what is the best in Chinese science fiction right now, they all point to him.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's really wonderful.
Interesting. So, how often do you read in Chinese as opposed to reading something in English?
Right now, for a bunch of reasons, I'm actually reading more in Chinese than I am in English.
Huh. Okay.
That's not normal.
Do you find that you... When you're reading in Chinese, do you find that you experience the story differently because of the language differences? As you said,
I actually don't
focus on nouns. No,
I actually don't. I do that thing that happens to people who learn two languages very early in their lives, mm-hmm. which is I get them mixed up and I interchange them. It's very hard for me to it's very hard for me to say something in Chinese and then not keep. Saying something, for example, when I talk to my family, a lot of times we will just switch back and forth between the two languages. Mm. By the way, I will point out this is actually one of my gripes with Firefly, is that it's a horribly inaccurate representation of what might happen if you had sort of this culture clash and these two languages melding.
It's true. You would have different words in English and Chinese in the same sentence.
So you wouldn't just reserve Chinese for swearing?
Yes.
That's not true.
You could.
You're bilingual, though, right?
No, I'm not, because my father was from Mexico, but he wanted very much to have his children assimilate, so he did not teach us to speak Spanish, and deliberately kept me from being a Spanish speaker, because he didn't want... I grew up in Southern California, and there was a lot of sort of Mexicans are being pushed away from... So I didn't speak Spanish as a child, and then when I was 12, he expected me to speak it perfectly and yelled at me when I would get anything wrong.
Oops.
So as a result, I'm very bad at Spanish. I can read and understand more than I can speak, but when I try to speak, I sound like a very confused and stuttering 3-year-old, so that's not so great.
But anyways, I think that's actually one of the reasons why I get all sort of tongue-tied when speaking to strangers, because I feel like... Because when I'm speaking to my family, I feel like I can always escape to the other language. And I realize when I'm talking to an absolute stranger, I probably can't do that. But even today, there are times when I will speak to somebody in English, and I'm like, the right word is Chinese. I cannot use this word.
So, that's definitely... Yeah, I'm actually better in languages that I study that aren't Spanish. I can speak French a bit better. I taught English in France for a couple of years.
Awesome.
So I'm better at French speaking than I am at Spanish speaking.
I read more Spanish and possibly Latin than anything else these days.
Latin? Cool.
Dude, I'm a grad student.
But I do actually like to... I like to listen to and read Spanish. So, I will watch TV in Spanish sometimes, or I have, for some reason... This magazine, Vanidades, gave me a subscription. I don't know why. They gave me a subscription to Vanidades, and Moss, my partner, who is white, a subscription to Black Enterprise. So we get these magazines every single month, and I read them both, and I'm always fascinated to see what's in them. Vanidades keeps me up on all celebrity gossip. But,
awesome. Very nice.
But yes, so I don't really do the, I don't do the code switching type of thing as much, except for because I learned English from a person whose first language was not English, I absorbed at a very early age some of the errors that he made until he died, which were like prepositional mostly, because prepositions are some of the hardest things to acquire. So if I'm tired, I will still sometimes say things like put it in the table instead of on the table, or because in Spanish, N is in and on.
Put it en la mesa.
Yeah, yeah. Put it en la mesa, which is like in the table or on the table. And, or he would say like, shut the light, close the light.
Oh, we have that in Chinese too.
Instead of like, shut off the light or turn off the light. Yeah. So those are the things that I will still do, even though that's not my, it's not a remnant of my having that language, which is an interesting kind of artifact.
Cool.
So I'm sure you have a website, and I know that you have some stories out there that people can read for free. Where can we find you?
Yeah. EliliU.com.
Very boring.
Why am I looking? Mine is my name, EmilyJiang.com. My last name is spelled J-I-A-N-G.
So we have two boring website names. What's yours?
Oh, mine's equally boring. It's JiangChu.net. J-H-I-C-H-U.net.
Net. Did someone take
.com was taken. So I have .net.
You should have done it. Oh yes, the actor guy.
Oh, is there an actor? Oh my, that's the same with me. An actor has mine.
Right, so I am .net. If you go to .com, that is not me.
And I will just say that both Emily and John have contributed to the anthology that I'm co-editing with Syra Ali to benefit Connor Bust, which is a charity that helps people of color attend conventions.
Right.
It's called In Other Words, and it's all poetry and flash by writers of color. And John has this lovely piece of flash, and Emily has a poem in it. So you can look for that coming out in May. And John has a story in Kaleidoscope, which is the other anthology that I'm co-editing. So he's everywhere.
Yeah, also I have a story coming out in Apex, I think, in April.
Wow.
And a story in Tor.com at the end of July.
So, yeah, congratulations, you're on fire. Good job.
Awesome. Well, all right, guys. Well, thank you, Emily, for coming on and talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us. This is great.
And thank you, Lily.
Pleasure.
And thank you, John.
Thank you.
And obviously, thanks, Julie, for being my co-host, Ninja.
Thank you, Sean.
Awesome.
Oh, for the record, the sales figures for the Three Bodies novel is 400,000 copies sold in Chinese, for the record.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of copies.
Yeah.
Woo! Okay.
All right. Well, on that note... Awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley. Last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.